during the presentation, particularly if he does not exhibit the minimum of humility and self-doubt that I would expect from someone practicing randomness. I will proudly bombard him with questions that he may not be prepared to answer, blinded by his past results. I will proudly lecture him that Machiavelli ascribed to luck at least a 50% role in life. The rest was cunning and bravura, and that was before the creation of modern markets. In this chapter, I discuss some well-known counterintuitive properties of performance records and historical time series. The concept presented here is well known for some of its variations under the names survivorship bias, data mining, data snooping, overfitting, regression to the mean, etc. Basically, situations where the performance is exaggerated by the observer, owing to a misperception of the importance of randomness. Clearly, this concept has rather unsettling implications. It extends to more general situations where randomness may play a share, such as the choice of a medical treatment or the interpretation of coincidental events. When I am tempted to suggest a possible future contribution of financial research to science in general, I adduce the analysis of data mining and the study of survivorship biases. These have been refined in finance, but can extend to all areas of scientific investigation. Why is finance so rich a field? Because it is one of the rare areas of investigation where we have plenty of information, in the form of abundant price series, but no ability to conduct experiments as in, say, physics. This dependence on past data brings about its salient defects. Fooled by numbers, placebo investors. I have often been faced with questions of the sort, "Who do you think you are to tell me that I might have been plain lucky in my life?" Well, nobody really believes that he or she was lucky. My approach is that, with our Monte Carlo engine, we can manufacture purely random situations. We can do the exact opposite of conventional methods. In place of analyzing real people, hunting for attributes, we can create artificial ones with precisely known attributes. Thus, we can manufacture situations that depend on pure, unadulterated luck, without the shadow of skills, or whatever we have called non-luck, hearkening back to the table I first described earlier in the book. In other words, we can man-make pure nobodies to laugh at. They will be, by design, stripped of any shadow of ability, exactly like a placebo drug. We saw in Chapter 5 how people may survive owing to traits that momentarily fit the given structure of randomness. Here, we take a far simpler situation where we know the structure of randomness. The first such exercise is a finessing of the old popular saying that even a broken clock is right twice a day. We will take it a bit further to show that statistics is a knife that cuts on both sides. Let us use the Monte Carlo generator introduced earlier and construct a population of 10,000 fictional investment managers. The generator is not terribly necessary, since we can use a coin or even do plain algebra, but it is considerably more illustrative and fun. Assume that they each have a perfectly fair game. Each one has a 50% probability of making $10,000 at the end of the year, and a 50% probability of losing $10,000. Let us introduce an additional restriction. Once a manager has a single bad year, he is thrown out of the sample. Goodbye, and have a nice life. Thus, we will operate like the legendary speculator, George Soros, who is said to tell his managers gathered in a room, "Half of you guys will be out by next year," with an Eastern European accent. Like Soros, we have extremely high standards. We are looking only for managers with an unblemished record. We have no patience for low performers. The Monte Carlo generator will toss a coin. Heads, and the manager will make $10,000 over the year. Tails, he will lose $10,000. We run it for the first year. At the end of the year, we expect 5,000 managers to be up $10,000 each, and 5,000 to be down $10,000. Now we run the game a second year. Again, we can expect 2,500 managers to be up 2 years in a row. Another year, 1,250. A fourth one, 625. A fifth, 313. We have now, simply in a fair game, 313 managers who made money for 5 years in a row, out of pure luck. Meanwhile, if we throw one of these successful traders into the real world, we would get very interesting and helpful comments on his remarkable style, his incisive mind, and the influences that helped him achieve such success. Some analysts may attribute his achievement to precise elements among his childhood experiences. His biographer will dwell on the wonderful role models provided by his parents. We would be supplied with black-and-white pictures in the middle of the book of a great mind in the making. And the following year, should he stop outperforming? Recall that his odds of having a good year have stayed at 50%. They would start laying blame, finding fault with the relaxation in his work ethics or his dissipated lifestyle. They will find something he did before, when he was successful, that he has subsequently stopped doing, and attribute his failure to that. The truth will be, however, that he simply ran out of luck. Nobody has to be competent. Let's push the argument further to make it more interesting. We create a cohort that is composed exclusively of incompetent managers. We will define an incompetent manager as someone who has a negative expected return, the equivalent of the odds being stacked against him. We instruct the Monte Carlo generator now to draw from an urn. The urn has 100 balls, 45 black and 55 red. By drawing with replacement, the ratio of red to black balls will remain the same. If we draw a black ball, the manager will earn $10,000. If we draw a red ball, he will lose $10,000. The manager is thus expected to earn $10,000 with 45% probability, and lose $10,000 with 55%. On average, the manager will lose $1,000 each round, but only on average. At the end of the first year, we still expect to have 4,500 managers turning a profit, 45% of them. The second, 45% of that number, 2,025. The third, 911. The fourth, 410. The fifth, 184. Let us give the surviving managers names and dress them in business suits. True, they represent less than 2% of the original cohort, but they will get attention. Nobody will mention the other 98%. What can we conclude? The first counterintuitive point is that a population entirely composed of bad managers will produce a small amount of great track records. As a matter of fact, assuming the manager shows up unsolicited at your door, it will be practically impossible to figure out whether he is good or bad. The results would not markedly change even if the population were composed entirely of managers who are expected in the long run to lose money. Why? Because owing to volatility, some of them will make money. We can see here that volatility actually helps bad investment decisions. The second counterintuitive point is that the expectation of the maximum of track records, with which we are concerned, depends more on the size of the initial sample than on the individual odds per manager. In other words, the number of managers with great track records in a given market depends far more on the number of people who started in the investment business, in place of going to dental school, rather than on their ability to produce profits. It also depends on the volatility. Why do I use the notion of expectation of the maximum? Because I am not concerned at all with the average track record. I will get to see only the best of the managers, not all of the managers. This means that we would see more excellent managers in 2006 than in 1998, provided the cohort of beginners was greater in 2001 than it was in 1993. I can safely say that it was. Regression to the mean. The hot hand in basketball is another example of misperception of random sequences. It is very likely in a large sample of players for one of them to have an inordinately lengthy lucky streak. As a matter of fact, it is very unlikely that an unspecified player somewhere does not have an inordinately lengthy lucky streak. This is a manifestation of the mechanism called regression to the mean. I can explain it as follows. Generate a long series of coin flips producing heads and tails with 50% odds each, and fill up sheets of paper. If the series is long enough, you may get 8 heads or 8 tails in a row, perhaps even 10 of each. Yet you know that in spite of these wins, the conditional odds of getting a head or a tail is still 50%. Imagine these heads and tails as monetary bets filling up the coffers of an individual. The deviation from the norm as seen in excess heads or excess tails is here entirely attributable to luck. In other words, to variance, not to the skills of the hypothetical player, since there is an even probability of getting either. A result is that in real life, the larger the deviation from the norm, the larger the probability of it coming from luck rather than skills. Consider that even if one has a 55% probability of heads, the odds of 10 wins is still very small. This can be easily verified in stories of very prominent people in trading rapidly reverting to obscurity, like the heroes I used to watch in trading rooms. This applies to height of individuals or the size of dogs. In the latter case, consider that two average-sized parents produce a large litter. The largest dogs, if they diverge too much from the average, will tend to produce offspring of smaller size than themselves, and vice versa. This reversion for the large outliers is what has been observed in history and explained as regression to the mean. Note that the larger the deviation, the more important its effect. Again, one word of warning. All deviations do not come from this effect, but a disproportionately large proportion of them do. Ergodicity. To get more technical, I have to say that people believe that they can figure out the properties of the distribution from the sample they are witnessing. When it comes to matters that depend on the maximum, it is altogether another distribution that is being inferred, that of the best performers. We call the difference between the average of such distribution and the unconditional distribution of winners and losers the survivorship bias. Here, the fact that about 3% of the initial cohort discussed earlier will make money 5 years in a row. In addition, this example illustrates the properties of ergodicity, namely, that time will eliminate the annoying effects of randomness. Looking forward, in spite of the fact that these managers were profitable in the past 5 years, we expect them to break even in any future time period. They will fare no better than those of the initial cohort who failed earlier in the exercise. The long term. A few years ago, when I told one Mr. A then master of the universe type, that track records were less relevant than he thought, he found the remark so offensive that he violently flung his cigarette lighter in my direction. The episode taught me a lot. Remember that nobody accepts randomness in his own success, only his failure. His ego was pumped up as he was heading up a department of great traders who were then temporarily making a fortune in the markets and attributing the idea to the soundness of their business, their insights, or their intelligence. They subsequently blew up during the harsh New York winter of 1994. It was the bond market crash that followed the surprise interest rate hike by Alan Greenspan. The interesting part is that several years later, I can hardly find any of them still trading. Ergodicity. Recall that the survivorship bias depends on the size of the initial population. The information that a person derived from profits in the past, just by itself, is neither meaningful nor relevant. We need to know the size of the population from which he came. In other words, without knowing how many managers out there have tried and failed, we will not be able to assess the validity of the track record. If the initial population includes 10 managers, then I would give the performer half my savings without a blink. If the initial population is composed of 10,000 managers, I would ignore the results. The latter situation is generally the case. These days, so many people have been drawn to the financial markets. Many college graduates are trading as a first career, failing, then going to dental school. If, as in a fairy tale, these fictional managers materialized into real human beings, one of these could be the person I am meeting tomorrow at 11:45 a.m. Why did I select 11:45 a.m.? Because I will question him about his trading style. I need to know how he trades. I will then be able to claim that I have to rush to a lunch appointment if the manager puts too much emphasis on his track record. Life is coincidental. Next, we look at the extensions to real life of our bias in the understanding of the distribution of coincidences. The mysterious letter. You get an anonymous letter on January 2nd, informing you that the market will go up during the month. It proves to be true, but you disregard it, owing to the well-known January effect. Stocks have gone up historically during January. Then you receive another one on February 1st, telling you that the market will go down. Again, it proves to be true. Then you get another letter on March 1st. Same story. By July, you are intrigued by the prescience of the anonymous person, and you are asked to invest in a special offshore fund. You pour all your savings into it. 2 months later, your money is gone. You go spill your tears on your neighbor's shoulder, and he tells you that he remembers that he received two such mysterious letters. But the mailing stopped at the second letter. He recalls that the first one was correct in its prediction, the other incorrect. What happened? The trick is as follows. The con operator pulls 10,000 names out of a phone book. He mails a bullish letter to one half of the sample and a bearish one to the other half. The following month, he selects the names of the persons to whom he mailed the letter whose prediction turned out to be right, that is, 5,000 names. The next month, he does the same with the remaining 2,500 names, until the list narrows down to 500 people. Of these, there will be 200 victims. An investment in a few thousand dollars worth of postage stamps will turn into several million. An interrupted tennis game. It is not uncommon for someone watching a tennis game on television to be bombarded by advertisements for funds that did, until that minute, outperform others by some percentage over some period. But again, why would anybody advertise if he didn't happen to outperform the market? There is a high probability of the investment coming to you if its success is caused entirely by randomness. This phenomenon is what economists and insurance people call adverse selection. Judging an investment that comes to you requires more stringent standards than judging an investment you seek, owing to such selection bias. For example, by going to a cohort composed of 10,000 managers, I have 2 in 100 chances of finding a spurious survivor. By staying home and answering my doorbell, the chance of the soliciting party being a spurious survivor is closer to 100%. Reverse survivors. We have so far discussed the spurious survivor. The same logic applies to the skilled person who has the odds markedly stacked in her favor, but who still ends up going to the cemetery. This effect is the exact opposite of the survivorship bias. Consider that all one needs is 2 bad years in the investment industry to terminate a risk-taking career, and that, even with great odds in one's favor, such an outcome is very possible. What do people do to survive? They maximize their odds of staying in the game by taking black swan risks, like John and Carlos, those that fare well most of the time, but incur a risk of blowing up. The birthday paradox. The most intuitive way to describe the data mining problem to a non-statistician is through what is called the birthday paradox, though it is not really a paradox.